We are starting the show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and story, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and mysticpete on social media. Today's show. First, I interview Larry Davidson, who has a one-man show at the Hollywood Fringe Festival. It's called The Undiscovered Country, A Skeptic's Guide to the Afterlife. And then I interview Kay Rowan Young, photographer. I think you'll enjoy both of these interviews. Very interesting. Also, a little homage to two important musicians who recently died. In the middle of the show, I play a piece by Vangelis, musician, composer, producer of electronic, progressive, and classical music. He scored a number of notable movies, including Chariots of Fire and Blade Runner. So we'll play Chariots of Fire. And then at the end, Pandit Shiv Kumar Sharma, a beloved santur player who is credited with adapting the santur to Indian classical music. The santur looks something like a hammer dulcimer. We will hear a selection from the Hamsidwani Raga. Stay tuned! May 19th, 2022, Mystic Pete here with Larry Davidson. And we go way back to some very cool underground Hollywood artsy, fartsy music scene. I was always a little more peripheral. You were a little bit more central to production. Now we just reconnected through
Roger.
Through Roger, a clown friend of mine, who was also part of that scene in general.
Yeah, he made the puppets. I have puppets in my show.
Puppets. You have a show, so Larry Davidson, The Undiscovered Country, A Skeptic's Guide to the Afterlife. And that's part of the Hollywood Fringe Festival, hollywoodfringe.org. You can just search Larry Davidson or The Undiscovered Country, A Skeptic's Guide to the Afterlife. You'll be on June 4th, 19th and 21st. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But first, I want to just like reminisce about the old days. There's a lot of positive things to say. You know, some complaints too. My overall complaint was that there was often great visionaries and great creativity and community. But a lot of times you put in energy into these projects. And, you know, some of those people on top, they just were happy to take your energy but didn't return it. So I guess I had felt that a few different times, and I think at some point I decided, like, yeah, I don't want to be working for free for any of these cool, fun things just to be a part of something awesome if I'm going to be exploited. So there's that side too. So there's some narcissism, and just like in any power dynamic, sometimes people start taking advantage. But not to say that the whole scene wasn't incredible and wonderful art was created in relationships and all of the above. Anyway, any comments about that?
Well, I mean, I agree. It was really, really exciting to be part of a big scene and a whole bunch of people and a crew and people working over me, people working under me. And I was part of this giant thing. I was a piece of it. But that's why I decided to do a one-man show, because now it's me.
And I made that decision along the lines somewhere too. And I play music. My thing is music meditation, and it's just me, and I'm on the radio. But I feel very strongly that if anybody ever does anything for me, I mean, if they're playing a gig with, I always give them a few bucks or take them out to dinner, or like make sure everybody feels appreciated. And I mean, unless there's just like it's a no money thing and we're all doing it for free, then, you know, you throw in if you want to. But I think it's very important to show gratitude even to the sidemans and so forth. It's just good karma, and it spreads a lot of good energy. So I feel very strongly about that in my creations. But so you've gone off and inspired by some of these past experiences and created your own show.
That's right. But again, it is a solo show, and I do play, I'm on stage and I play about, I don't know, 15, 20 different characters. But I do have a director and a producer. I couldn't do it all by myself. Extreme gratitude to my director, Heather Dowling, and my producer, Jessica Lynn Johnson, and all of the people in the Soaring Solo community who have inspired me and also, you know, cheered me on when I needed cheering on. So with that said, it is a solo show. It's like I'm on stage by myself. I'm responsible. There's a lot of pressure, but it's also kind of a relief to not be relying on other cast members, maybe flaking and not showing up to rehearsal. And there's an empowerment and also a humility to seeing how much work goes into it also. I mean, this is huge for me, just doing this by myself after being used to working with a huge crew. Because Dream Circus was a huge crew, you know, hundreds, I don't know how many people were involved in that. It was easy to be part of it, but it was also easy to get lost in it.
And that's the thing, is at some point, our art gets stronger. We either kind of move on to something else, or our art gets stronger. We want to have our own voice. We don't want to just be a little cog in a machine, appreciate it or no. And here you've come up with a one-man show, and we're going to talk about what the content is, because it's very interesting. But to get on stage for an hour alone and hold an audience's attention, or even better yet, move them and inspire them and make them cry or laugh, you know, that's quite an epic undertaking. I'm on radio, holding people's attention for 5 minutes is hard. Like, half the people already tuned out because I'm talking too much. No, it's a joke. So yeah, good for you. And I know you're stepping up. You're finding it. So you're emerging as a solo artist from the kind of comfort, like the table is set in these more like group community settings, but now it's just you.
Yes, it's just me. And also, yeah, as you say, capturing the attention of, and I think it's more difficult to get audiences' attention today. I mean, there's so many distractions, and to just be on stage and tell a story for an hour, that's a lot to ask of an audience. So I try to make sure that I'm not just talking for an hour.
And it's hard to get people to come to see a show.
Well, first of all, just finding parking in Hollywood, getting out of your house after a pandemic. We're so used to being in our, like, you know, I think my agoraphobia, kicked in during this pandemic, where it's harder for me to get out of the house. I really need a good excuse.
Well, wait, even before that, it's hard getting out of the womb and then going to school and making a living and a job and then getting a pandemic and getting out of your house to Hollywood parking to go. Okay, let's talk about this show. You are dealing with this event in your life where you had a near-death experience.
That's right. And again, I've actually done research in this, because what exactly does it mean to have a near-death experience? Like, you die or you don't die. So I'm here, so I didn't die, but I did die because I flatlined and I was clinically declared dead. And in that moment, I don't know if it was a minute or 2 minutes or eternity, a lot happened. And then I was in and out of a coma. And then at some point, I was sort of became conscious again. And then I had a lot to try to figure out and process. And then try to tell somebody about it, that was even harder. Like, how do I describe what happened? Which is why I wrote a show about it.
Well, I'm an actual mystic, Mystic Pete. You can tell by the name. I'm not like Parachute Pete or Plumber Pete. Mystic Pete, right? So I'm really into this stuff. And how do I put it? I talk to dead people. So this realm I'm very interested in. And I would say I've done a lot of work relating to this kind of transcendental space you're talking about. So just tell us a little about what happened in that 1 minute or eternity.
Well, again, I don't want to do too many spoilers from the show.
Oh, okay. But come and see the show if you want to.
But I mean, there's some background that I think might be interesting. First of all, it started as a TED Talk before the pandemic. I came out of the hospital and people were asking me, what's it like? What's a near-death experience? Is it the light at the end of the tunnel? Do you see Jesus? You know, do you see Buddha? And I said, and I was trying to describe it. I just said, I'm going to make a TED Talk about it. And I started to write a TED Talk about it. And then the pandemic hit, so they didn't have any TED Talks. But then I also decided, even just giving a 12-minute, I think they're 12 minutes, there were all these limits on the TED Talk, even 12 minutes doesn't do this justice. I wanted to make it, what I had was an experience, it was an experience. So I wanted to create an experience for the audience where it's like, I'm sitting in the audience, but I kind of have an idea of what that might've been like. So I interact with the audience. There's some games, there's some magic tricks, there's some things that get the audience involved. So they're not just sitting and listening to a story or watching a show, but they're maybe having an experience of like maybe hopefully amazement and wonder where their mind is blown a little bit, because the experience is mind blowing basically.
Well, in a TED Talk, you can't use puppets. So
that's right.
There we go. Hollywood Fringe Festival.
And you haven't had a true near death experience without puppets. So
that's what I'm talking about.
All of the research.
As a mystic, I can vouch for that one. It's just full of puppets in that interdimensional world. One of the main questions I have, well, humans have near-death experiences. Do spirits have near-life experiences? Okay. They say, like, your whole life flashes before your eyes when you're dying. And that's why I don't like to clean my bathroom much, because I don't want it to be all about cleaning toilets, you know, my brush with death. Okay, I'm using my material here.
Okay,
which is not landing very well.
Well, I haven't had to use the bathroom yet. I'm a little afraid. So the question was about spirits or about bathrooms?
About a story about Mexico.
Oh, story about spirits.
I love it.
A story about spirits. Well, this is actually my second near-death experience, and I talk about it very briefly in the show, so this is not a spoiler, because I actually would like to go into more detail.
Your second near-death
experience that I wrote the show about was my second near-death experience. My first near-death experience happened when I was very young, in my 20s, and I was scuba diving in Mexico in a church. So you're asking, how do I scuba dive in a church? It was like a town that sunk underground and then was covered with water. So I was a beginning scuba diver. And I was using equipment that was lent to me, and I was scuba diving through an underwater cemetery and through a church. Somehow, when I'm in the steeple of the church, so you can actually like scuba dive and scuba dive through the steeple of the church, my regulator stopped working, which means that I'm not breathing anymore. And that's when, after a while of that, all of a sudden I blanked out, and I had that classic experience of light in the tunnel. Although the light at the end of the tunnel may be of the sun shining through the hole of the steeple at the top. It might have been that, but I saw like this big flash of light and all of that. And then all of a sudden I started to breathe again, because one of the other scuba divers realized that I was missing and found me and gave me enough air to breathe that I like regained consciousness. So I didn't even count that as a near-death experience, because I just kind of went on with my life and didn't have time to process it or think about what happened. And it wasn't, you know, there wasn't a huge story around it. It was just, I lost consciousness. I saw a flash. I saw the light at the end of the tunnel. And I just went along with my life.
And it wasn't earth-shattering. It didn't change your consciousness and like, oh, I need to begin a whole new way of appreciating people or something like that.
No, because I was a young apple, probably. And I don't think I was conscious enough to like say, wow, that was a message from above or something. It was just kind of like, oh my God, I almost died. But it wasn't almost died, because I definitely had like a visionary experience, but I kind of didn't want to admit that. I didn't want to like say I had this experience, and I wasn't very spiritual or conscious at that point to really know what it was. But then this next experience happened, and I was in same place, Michoacán, Mexico, and I'm eating seafood, and I'm looking at a mural on the wall, and it's that sunken church, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, I've been here before. Was that where I had that scuba diving accident? And I was eating seafood, and that night I got sick. And that's when this whole thing started, which I talk about more in the show. But basically, it was some sort of food poisoning that opened up my intestines, and I got sepsis from this food. And I think it was that restaurant, looking at that picture, and someone told me the spirits came to get me the second time because they didn't get me the first time.
Wow.
So like I came back and like showed myself, and they were like, screw you, man, we're gonna get you this time. But they didn't get me the second time.
You cheated the devil twice.
Yes.
I think we can take from this experience, do not eat cheap seafood in some small Mexican restaurant.
Well, I don't know if it was cheap, okay. But and I don't know for sure, like everything in this story, like I'm not gonna who knows what happened, but I did get sick, and it did happen there. It did happen in while I was looking at the picture of that church, and the first time I died was in an underwater church. So I let the audience put the pieces together and decide what they will.
By the way, I'm talking with Larry Davidson. He has a one-man show called The Undiscovered Country, A Skeptic's Guide to the Afterlife, Hollywood Fringe Festival, June 4th, 19th, and 21st. You can go to hollywoodfringe.org for more information. Well, let's go back to where we started the interview, early days. We didn't know each other well, but we were just in some of the same scenes. And I will say that on the one hand, I loved being a part of these creative ventures, and I loved meeting people, seeing where the edge of human creation was, you know, West Coast and just interesting people and ravers and electronic music and dance and Blue Girl painting her naked body in blue. And
I remember Blue Girl, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of these things were very important to me, and I'm really glad I was part of everything I chose to be a part of. And yet, in some of these scenes, there's also this light and the dark. There's a lot of drugs. There's a lot of narcissism. There's a lot of look at me, look at me. Like, I think I was really wanting something a little bit more sweet, homey community hangout. So I didn't really find that piece of it, although I found that in other scenes. But I found this kind of creative force also in the folk scene, in the open mic scene. You know, like, it shows up around civilization here and there, and you got to keep your eyes open, and then it's gone. Everything can't be everything to every person. We take what we need and keep improving and developing ourselves, and eventually follow our own muse, because that's really the only thing that's going to really fit our calling. Tell me a little more about your experience back in those days.
Well, I think one of the things, again, one of the themes of my show is faith. Even it's called A Skeptic's Guide to the Afterlife, but I think that I did develop some faith, which whatever that means. But I did discover some faith in that scene, because a lot of times we would be putting things together, and my doubtful, skeptical mind is like, there's no way that we're going to have this show ready by tonight. You know, like, we just rented this place. No one's ready. Everybody's, you know, not paying attention. It's not even decorated. And like, I have all these words saying, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. This is what I've heard my whole life. And then all of a sudden, like, the show's about to start, and it's on. It's working. Like, all the pieces came together. And I feel the same with this. It's like, I want to give up sometimes. And like, I don't see how I'm going to have this ready by June 4th. But I keep saying, I saw this happen. I saw, like, incredible things come together. And it's almost like I don't even know how that happened. I can't, like, logically sit down and say, well, it was all planned, because a lot of it wasn't planned. A lot of it was, like, sort of spontaneous, and yet it happened. So it did teach me to kind of, again, a theme is surrender. Like, believe it's going to happen, and somehow this show got this empty room turned into a club with people showed up, and It happened, and I saw that over and over again. And even if you've ever been to Burning Man, like, a lot of that is like, there's so many things that could go wrong and do go wrong, and yet somehow it ends up being perfect in terms of, there's whatever experience you got out of it was the experience you meant to get out of it. I know my first year at Burning Man, everything went wrong. The car broke down. I thought I was going to be abandoned out there. Like, everything that could go wrong did go wrong, and yet I came out of that transformed, because I also did learn to kind of maybe give up on plans and expectations, and just have the end goal. I'm going to put on this show, or I'm going to get to Burning Man, or we're going to get to our destination. I don't know exactly how, but it's going to happen, and it did. And I saw that over and over again. So there was sort of it was very spiritual for me in that way, you know, giving up my overthinking and overplanning brain and seeing that these people just believed and made it happen.
I think we're also talking around another issue that I've put a lot of thought into, and that's, well, there's these two forces in society. There's like the kind of corporate, business, religious culture of organization and trying to control everything and then extracting resources from people. They want people's money, their attention, their sexuality, and they function well by trying to control every little piece of it and then just siphoning off life force. God, that sounds parasitic. It is. And then there's this whole other side that's chaotic, rebellious, breaking down structures, iconoclastic, nihilistic, or dangerous. The rebel. And it's certainly showing up with some of these Hollywood art scenes that we've been a part of. Burning Man and a lot of the festivals around. But then you see all of that trying to be like squeezed back into a corporate structure, like the corporations try to like discern what the cool stuff is and then monetize it. And you know, we're all aware of this too, but I mean, you can even watch commercials on TV and they'll like pull out little vignettes of people being cool and having fun and taking chances and taking risks to sell toothpaste. But then there's the real experience of it, which can be dangerous and no rules, no organization or poor organization, but it can be like a blast.
And well, yeah, I mean, that's one thing that I've been thinking about a lot is because I have to promote this show and I don't like promoting. I don't like going on Facebook and talking about the show. I don't like the promotion part. And part of the whole Dream Circus scene and that whole scene, there was promotion, but there was no internet. Like, we had email, but we didn't have Facebook and Instagram and all of that stuff. And I remember there'd be like map points and you would get a map and we had Thomas Brothers back then. It was no GPS and it would be like weird little places in LA that you would have to like find, you know, little side streets and to find these things. And it was a lot of word of mouth. It wasn't like the kind of corporate promotion machine that, like, even in the Fringe Festival, some people just have lots of money for advertising and promotion. And I love the kind of organic that it would be this obscure location and you kind of found it or you heard about it somehow, and then you would arrive at this destination, there'd be all these people, and how did they find this thing? How, you know, it wasn't through the kind of promotion that we have now. It was a word of mouth promotion. And
well, people show up and it had magnetism because it was cool.
Yeah, exactly.
It was just a really neat, dynamic, vibrant scene.
Exactly. And I kind of wish, like, I kind of wish, like, I can just say, hey, my show is super cool, and people will just show up, and I don't have to promote it. It's because it is cool. And I just kind of, that the vibe is out there, and that people will recognize it as cool the way those shows were. And you didn't really have to go out there and talk about how great it was. It just, you know, it lived on its own. Does that make sense?
Well, I think in a healthy civilization, it's mostly about organization, business, government, religion, supporting that which is creative and dynamic and loving and brings people health and together. It supports community. Right now, it's not. Right now, it's that all that organization is parasitic. But in a healthy world, the money wheels will be giving to the art force. And that's when a guy like you can get on stage and pour his heart out and enchant us for an hour. And you don't have to worry about filling seats because there are people out there that are just happy to see such talent be recognized. That's a good situation.
Well, I also love the idea that it's the Fringe Festival. Like, a lot of people don't know what the Fringe Festival is. Do you know what the Fringe Festival is, actually?
Many, many years.
Yeah, well, I mean, it started in Edinburgh, I think, after World War II,
yeah,
where there was this, like, you know, the respected theater that you had to get money and sponsors. And then there were people say, hey, we just want to do a show. And it was in people's basements or in the back of churches. And they said, what about us? We don't have all this money. We don't have these giant sponsors. We just want to do a show. So the Fringe was started exactly that. And then it went global. So there's actually, I looked this up, and globally, it sells the third most tickets in the world behind the Olympics and the World Cup. So, like, all the tickets from all the Hollywood, all the Fringe shows. So that's a huge thing to be a part of. But the whole idea of it, of being part of this alternative theater, where someone like me, who I don't, you know, someone, I could do my show, a show about my near-death experience. And I don't need corporate backing to do it. I don't have corporate backing.
One summer, I was part of the Fringe of the Fringe. There was that.
Right.
Like, acts that either were too weird or weren't good enough for the Fringe Festival. So, if you guys can get yourself over, you guys meaning the audience, the radio listening audience, The Undiscovered Country, A Skeptic's Guide to the Afterlife. And this is put together by Larry Davidson. More information at hollywoodfringe.org and a whole lot of other shows that you will be very interested in seeing. June 4th, 19th, and 21st is when you can see Larry. Thank you so much for coming into studio.
Thank you. This was great. And I love KXLU. This was the station that I listened to, the only station I listened to in my college days when it was part of the thriving punk scene, when we would go to the punk shows and KXLU was the only station that played the kind of music that you couldn't hear on any of the other stations.
You know why you listened? We're cool.
That's right.
It is March 23rd, 2022. Mystic Pete here with Kay Rowan Young. Hi, Kay.
Hi, Pete.
You're a photographer I've seen around the community for years, I guess. I don't think we really connected until a few days ago when our buddy Louie kind of said, hey, and we were down at the beach and you were filming some of the extraordinary classic cars down there.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to reach out to you, get you on radio. I feel like there is some kind of resonance between us. And it's this, that my specialty is this tier of creativity in Los Angeles that's not necessarily celebrity and star, but it's like the real kind of rootsy talent. And there's so much of it in LA that doesn't often get the exposure it should. And I feel like mass media, radio and TV, should that all be for like corporate interests and the official big creative people? Or what about like the real people doing creative work in the community? And I felt that way about your photographs, that you're in that tier. Like you kind of get into these little places and find the imagery that, you know, maybe it doesn't all have that frosting and pizzazz that people want to see on magazine covers, although some of your work is like that, but it has a lot of substance and depth. So here you are.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that observation. Thank you. I'm just somebody who takes photographs. It's a passion that I do. In my day job, my actual day job, I am a location scout and a location manager for films and television. And that involves scouting locations, you know, and bringing options to the creatives for them to choose. Okay, we want to do this scene here. I could be standing in, you know, somebody's house and standing in the corner of their kitchen and just taking a bunch of photos. Or I could be in Iceland taking photos of a road for a movie or something. Not that I have recently, but that's where I started taking photographs regularly. Every day, you just grab a camera and you go out. And it was back in the day of film.
What's that?
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
You remember those sort of kind of glossy pieces of paper that we used to take to those shacks?
Yeah.
The rolls, and then the shack would give you
little holes on the sides of it or so.
Yeah, okay. And then you take those little rolls, and then the guy in the little
hut,
right? He would pump out 24 to 36, depending on the role you gave him. And then you would sit there. And so we would tape these film prints together in a pan, right? There was no such thing as a panoramic, you know, for whatever. So you would tape these photographs, these actual prints together with Scotch tape and tape them down into a folder and then hand these folders over to the creatives. It was a massive process every day. And back in the day, there were those 23-minute photos or one-hour photos all around Los Angeles. So I could go to six or seven different locations, houses, restaurants, whatever, and take tons and tons of pictures and dump a bunch of rolls at the end of the day, like, you know, 4 o'clock or something when the lights started to get low. And then you'd sit there and you would just wait with your coffee and you'd put your file folders together, getting them ready. You'd pull out this massive roll of Scotch tape and you'd sit there and wait. And as they handed you one roll after another, as they started to pump out, then you'd just go through them and try and organize. Oh, this was that location. This was that location. And then you'd start taping so that at the next morning, you could hand over your stack of locations for somebody to quickly go, no. What else you got?
Right. I'm guessing that a lot of people hearing this will have no idea what you're talking about these photo huts. I mean, this is just the way life was not too long ago. But everybody has a phone now with a camera.
With a good camera.
Than the best cameras we had 20 and 30 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But some scouts now, you know, they will use those incredible phones and they will just take a pan or take single photos and then you just upload them digitally. And it's easier, but then there's more content now. clearly. Like before, when we shot with film, you were intentional with what you're taking a photograph. You had 36 shots. Maybe you got that bonus 37. And... You know, right. You're like, woo-woo, ching-ching.
And you're paying to, for the film, you're paying to develop it, you're waiting. So you have to be strategic.
Yeah. And you're not just going to rattle off a bunch because that's just more junk that you have to parse through and maybe tape together. It's like, no. I'm going to go 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5, 6 to get across this small room. Yeah. I'm not going to go, I'm going to be very careful about making sure they line up well. So there's no crazy overlap and all that stuff. So that was film. That was back in the day. And I bought my first good, you know, official amateur, professional amateur camera on the job and learned how to use it for those purposes of location scouting. And then we moved to digital. And it's all the same sort of idea, except there's a... I think it tends to be a little more forgiving, but you still have to understand lighting, maybe setting your camera to a manual focus so that, you know, you don't end up with different swaths of light across a room, and particularly if you're going to tape them together in a pan. But I think that during the pandemic, I really started to figure out, because I was also one of those people, Pete, that would take the manual to the camera. Some of those suckers are pretty wordy, and I swear to you, that thing would fly over my shoulder in a minute. You know, I'm sort of the monkey who just sort of tries pressing buttons.
yeah, I'm that way too.
Okay,
and some people 5 years later, you figure out, oh, you take the lens cap off first. Yeah, right.
Oh, that's why my pictures are fuzzy, right? I had it set for M instead of whatever. I don't know. It's been a process, because I started location managing and scouting over 20 years ago now. So the journey of how to use a camera for me has been a long one. And I mean, now that I'm also doing it as a passion hobby and finding all the great things to shoot locally, like really being focused on it now. I think I'm learning so much more about photography. I watch other photographers more. I observe other photographs. Instagram is great for that. For better, for worse.
Well, I mean, that brings up an interesting question. When everybody's a photographer, which everybody is now,
yeah.
I mean, there's just this ocean of imagery. Maybe that's good. Maybe everybody's becoming more artistic. Or does it kind of dumb down everything? Same issue in music, a musician. Mm-hmm. And there's a sea of music coming out of it, dance track. I mean, you can almost press a button and the computer will spit out a whole track for you without much creativity or thought. And is that a good thing? Or is it just so much noise now, it's very hard for real art, something really brilliant to surface? Because it's in this wash of information.
Well, I can't answer for like the grand scope of things. I know I'm trying to be a fish swimming in the wash, right? I'm trying to come up through the wash.
Yeah, well, and to like someone like you who's doing extraordinary work.
I appreciate that. Yeah,
obviously, anybody who goes to your website will agree with me. Like, but how does that rise above the din? That's
the question.
That's the challenge that artists have right now. Yeah. And then it often becomes a question of celebrity and branding. Who's the best at selling themselves? And you get mediocre people who are just great at shouting loudly and have a pretty face rather than real talents. Who often we're shy people and we don't really feel like waving our arms. Look at me, look at me.
Right, right. I would make a blanket statement and say majority of people who are artistic and creative and really love doing that end of things are horrible at marketing, because that's the hardest part. selling yourself.
We hate it. We hate selling, filling up an event with people who want to hear, like, we want to come and play music and not sell tickets.
Right.
We don't want to do the flyer. We hate that stuff.
I want to believe. Here's one thought I have. I want to believe that audiences, particularly younger audiences that are so are processing so much stimuli now, that they have the ability to process it and discern, hopefully, a little bit better, maybe not, but having said that, you and I are coming from, because I'm going to make a leap here and say that we're not too far in age.
Okay.
25? Exactly. Yeah. I'm not quite 30, but okay. Okay. No. But, shakes head no. But you and I are coming at it from an age where there, you know, maybe there wasn't the internet, the World Wide Webs, I think they call it. And so in order to get exposed to anything, music, whatever, you had to physically go somewhere, you had to look at it, you had to go physically go somewhere, you had to listen to it, you maybe turned on your dial, right? You tuned in the antenna and the whole thing. Now, people, it's a push of a button. You remember how we used to go to the encyclopedias to get the information for the book report or whatever? Now, it's everything is right. It's right here in these cameras that we carry in our pockets. Like my son, I hope that he is more discerning. He is able to say, that is a lot of garbage, but this is the one thing that I like. And I'm hoping that a younger or an audience that has gotten used to the stimuli can also wade through faster and get to the thing that they like. Get to the thing that moves them. That's my hope. I don't know if it's happening.
Begs the question, is the next generation coming up a bunch of digitally sophisticated, emotionally stunted robots who only know how to work technology but have lost social skills and artistic skills in favor of all this Instagram noise, this look at me culture, and kitty videos. I like kitty videos.
What's a kitty video?
Little cats.
Oh, like little cats playing
with cat videos. I don't know. I've fallen into it.
Oh no,
I've
it's succumbed. A rabbit. It's a kitty hole. It's a K hole.
It's a K hole. I'm in a K hole. Ignore the glassy eyes. See, our conversation just got very big. We're solving all the world's problems. I knew you would make a great interview subject. That's part of what I can kind of sniff out. Oh, they have something to say.
Oh, that's what, she's not just some crazy lady who crouches between classic cars and shoots their hubcaps.
And that was cool. Like the angles you're getting on these classic cars, like are like extraordinary. Like people don't really think about that, but you do. And that's, oh, this lady's has a vision. Literal and metaphorical.
Sure, I lay down on my stomach in like full war photographer pose. Somebody suggested that, like war photographer, and then I have a like tripod pose. And okay, but to answer your question, is the younger generation XYZ? Yes and no. Yes, some of them are, and no, some of them are able to find out how to be creative with all the digital stuff. It's just a different form of creativity than you and I putting a record on the techniques and touching it with our fingers and spinning it. And, you know, it's a different type of creativity.
Okay.
I think.
It's a very good insight. And I think you're right. But I also think we are in this moment of maladaptive consciousness. Like things are moving so quickly and changing so radically, we're just floundering, we're flailing our arms. A few people are able to breathe, keep their nose above water, but most people are terrified. And we'll keep expanding the conversation. There's all these cults and ideologies and politics that try to take advantage of that disassociation.
Yeah.
And so you see this trend towards cultishness and extremist politics and scaring people and saying, those people over there are the problem, and these waves of like really scary stuff happening in the world in this time of rapid change and disorientation.
Yeah. Well, the reality is that things are always changing rapidly. Always. They always have been.
Huh.
And they always will be.
Oh, ask the guy in 1600s about the new plow. Right?
Right? Honestly, nothing's permanent, Pete. Nothing ever sticks around for longer than, you know?
Good point.
Everything is impermanent. And our issue is, my issue is, that if I don't accept that everything is impermanent, nothing is here to stay, then I'm gonna suffer over hanging on to something that is, you can't hang on to anything. You cannot, right? No feelings, no, you and I are decaying at this very moment,
oh,
right?
Oh, Lord, I was hoping no one would notice.
Right, sorry about that. I'll wipe that off your table then. But I mean, like, if I look at it in that way, yes, everything is changing very rapidly. But the reality is, I remind myself that everything changes. Everything has always changed. Our fear comes from not being able to accept it. Yeah. Once we sort of get our heads wrapped around the fact that nothing is here, nothing can stay in our possession. Nothing is here, and you know. What am I spouting? I'm spouting stuff that I heard from, you know, this Buddhist guy or that Buddhist guy or, you know, from that program or that program. But if I'm going to cling to anything, I'm going to cling to that. I'll cling to the idea that everything is in constant change. And if I can get on board with that reality, then I'm not going to fall into extremist tactics of fear. And that's where I have to sit, to keep my brain from going bananas, going into all those modes.
Panic mode.
Reactive mode.
Yeah. And then somebody comes along and has the answer. And little do we know.
Yeah.
They're pure evil. Well, now here we are, a couple of creatives, philosophers, sitting around near the beach in Santa Monica. Solving all the world's problems.
Good. You're welcome, world.
Done. Okay. Well, so now let's narrow the focus a little bit. I realize for me to narrow the focus, I should probably get surgery to get my eyes smaller. No, I don't know what that means. Your photography. You are looking at things from a little different point of view, and that's what makes it so exciting for me. Like you're getting down on the floor and look. I mean, tell me a little about the creative process for you.
It's a little bit buckshot theory in that everything has beauty. I can look at everything and find something neat. Because my brain likes to, you know, I'll come up with a story about that person cruising by, you know, or I'll want to know that person's story. What's up? What's up with that? That car that I'll take a picture of has to have come from somewhere. I'm curious about that car story and my addiction, my obsession with taking photographs, you know, as many photographs as I can, is just me trying to, well, that's me trying to cling to something that may not be there tomorrow. I don't know, you know? So I'm just hanging on to, the beauty that I see.
Mm.
I'll take photos, take lots and lots of photos of something. I can do a photograph standing on the street and, you know, somebody's leopard, you know, jacket, fuzzy jacket. My eye will get drawn to that and then it will notice that the thing behind them, a billboard behind them has a similar color. And boom, sometimes it's intuitive for me. Like I don't actually see it. I just take these photographs because there's something. The way the light flare comes in, I mean, really, isn't that photography? All of photography is just taking pictures of light.
Hmm.
It's not so much the subject. It's about how the light is shining on it to some degree. I haven't really found a niche, I guess, for myself. If you have looked at my website or my Instagram, then you'll notice that there's a swath of different, there's a variety of different subject matter, as it were. It tends to be local here, Venice and Santa Monica.
And you even do weddings and
I actually did a bar mitzvah for a very cool kid named Arlo over the weekend. I just want to take photographs to, I don't know. That's a big question. I just take photographs. I'm just driven. And that is probably an obsession or addiction that I have, is just to take all these photographs so I can hold on to the beauty that is just, sometimes it's just everyday things, life, happenings. Sometimes it's something cool, you know, like those characters in Venice. Sometimes it's just the sunset. Sometimes it's the bench in front of the sunset. And I don't know, maybe because I'm short, you know, my perspective already starts at a different angle than a lot of people's. And because I want a buckshot, I want to see all of these things and understand them from all different points of view and angles. I go high, I go low, I get really low down on the ground. And then I end up with, you know, 1,200 photos from the bar mitzvah, Arlo's bar mitzvah.
So it sounds like a combination of your unique perspective. You allow in a little bit of wildness and chaos, a whole lot of passion and instinct, and just throw yourself upon the photography canvas and let it happen.
You make it sound like it's a stew or a jambalaya, but yeah.
I'm trying to put it into words. That's what great. I get paid to do.
That's perfect. My photography is a jambalaya of all sorts of stuff.
There's passion and spontaneity underneath it all. I think that can be said for a lot of the arts. Here's another resonance or a way to say the similarity between you and I. You said there can be beauty or interest in anything, and I can interview anybody and it'll be an interesting, everybody has a story, and it's just settling down and asking the right questions and letting people emerge. Like anybody could give a good interview. So this is right here.
Fingers crossed. But that's a compassionate viewpoint that you have, to acknowledge that you must be a compassionate person if you're acknowledging that everybody has a story, right? And it is their own story and not your take on it, or just, you know, the imaginations that you've created in your head. A curiosity and a compassion. You must have that.
I'll take it. And we've just mutually complimented each other. So this interview is going...
We're checking boxes all along the way.
Good interview. Just wrapping it up here. So krowanyoung.com. Your name is spelled K-E-I. It's pronounced like the letter K. It's spelled K-E-I. rowanyoung.com for all things K.
All things me.
coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. I started the show with an interview with Larry Davidson, his show, The Undiscovered Country, A Skeptic's Guide to the Afterlife, will be at the Hollywood Fringe Festival. And I'm sure you enjoyed my interview with photographer K. Rowan Young. And musical interludes by First Vangelis, that was Chariots of Fire, he recently passed. And we just finished music by Pandit Shiv Kumar Sharma, Santur player, who also just sadly passed. This was called Hamsidwani Raga. We'll be back next week with the finest of talk radio. Misty Pete out.